I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is author of books on work, management, and behavioral science, Daniel Pink. He's joined in conversation by Wired Magazine's Nicholas Thompson. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Daniel Pink and Nicholas Thompson.
We love to say timing is everything, but often we don't act like it. As we're about to find out, timing really can be everything, and often we've got it all wrong. Luckily, Daniel Pink is here to the rescue. Daniel is the author of 6 books, including the long-running New York Times bestsellers Drive, To Sell as Human, and A Whole New Mind. His books have been translated into 33 languages and have sold more than 1 million copies in the United States alone. His new best-selling book is When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. It's loaded with information on the best time to do almost anything, including the best time to get married, switch careers, or get a colonoscopy. It's all very important stuff. Appearing in conversation with Dan this evening is Nicholas Thompson, editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine. Let's give them a warm welcome to the JCC.
Good evening. I am delighted to be here with Daniel Pink. Good to see you.
Thanks for spending Valentine's Day with me.
So I'm just going to start by saying this book is fantastic. I imagine some of you have read it. Some of you probably have not. It will amuse you. It will enlighten you. It will make you a better person. And it will make you feel good about taking naps. So good stuff here,
right.
Dan.
Well, and thank you for coming.
Let's get cracking. So you call this not a how-to book.
Correct.
But a when-to book.
Right.
It's like the first line that made me laugh. It's on page 2.
Okay.
How did you come up with the idea? What was the inspiration? Why did you say, you know what? I want to do a book on timing.
You know what? It was, Nick, it was a mix of curiosity and frustration, like many things in my life. It was a mix of curiosity and frustration. I was frustrated because I was making all kinds of timing decisions myself. Mm-hmm. When should I exercise? When should I do some kind of work? When should I do other kinds of work? When should I start a project? When should I abandon a project? And I was making them in a pretty haphazard way. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make them in a better way. I started looking around for some guidance. It didn't exist. And then, here's where the curiosity comes in, said, I wonder if there's research on this. And that took me down a rabbit hole, basically 2-year rabbit hole, where I saw this incredible, incredible array of research. Not in one field, not in 2 fields, but in dozens and dozens and dozens of fields where scholars all over the world are asking what turn out to be very similar questions. What is the effect of time of day on how we feel and what we do? Why do breaks matter? How do midpoints affect our behavior? How do beginnings affect our behavior? How do groups synchronize in time? And I found it, you know, quite fascinating, and it's one of those areas where the science can yield very specific practical things we can do in our own life.
So it felt like an area where there's lots of research, but no one has synthesized it.
Yeah, well, it's...
And also it will help you get through the day.
Right, it was mostly about me, right? Basically, how do I survive? How do I survive the day? But it wasn't only synthesis, Nick. Basically what it was, and this is a problem in the academic world, is that you have these people in different disciplines never talk to each other. I mean, you know that from your own journalism. And so, you know, the cognitive psychologists don't talk to the personality psychologists, who don't talk to the social psychologists. They don't talk to the economists. No one's talking to the endocrinologists. You know, and yet they're actually in this fairly common pursuit, and sometimes it takes an outsider to step back and say, "Hey, guys, you're asking all similar questions."
And so you agree, you decide to write this book, you pursue it, and then you do one of the productivity hacks. I don't know, you maybe get to it on about page 200. You write down models for how this book will turn out badly. I want you to talk about some of your productivity hacks. This is the one that blew my mind.
Yeah, okay.
Explain this to the audience.
So this is something, and this is in the chapter on how do you, you know, on how do you avoid a bad beginning. And one of the best things I've done, and I do this all the time, is something called a pre-mortem. All right? So you've heard about You've heard about a postmortem, right? The body dies, and you go and you figure out what went wrong. Mm-hmm. A premortem is you do that before the body dies, all right? And so let's say you have a project. You have a project, and you say at the beginning of the project, before you even get started, you go, say, 1 year later when the project is over and say, this project was an abject disaster. What went wrong? And you begin to work to see what are the things that would have contributed to this project going awry? And then you write down those things and don't do them. And so for me, but I'm serious about this, for me, I did a pre-mortem on this book, on basically how to write a book, and I knew that projecting forward 2 years, if I didn't write a book, or say I had written a bad book, which is even worse than not writing a book, what went wrong in my life? And I realized that I didn't write every day, which is something I need to do in order to get the pages to pile up. I didn't keep my editor posted on what I was doing. I had a 1.5 research assistants for this book, and I didn't like work well and early and deliberately with my research assistants. And I didn't say no to everything that wasn't writing the book. I knew that I knew what would go wrong, and so I actually had a little card on my desk with those four things, not to do them.
So you come up with the idea. You come up with your list of
they were
hacks.
They were more underwhelmed by this hack than I would have expected.
The audience?
Yeah. I don't know if they were overwhelmed or underwhelmed. I think they were simply whelmed right there by that.
I want to do this for everything.
You should. As a magazine editor, as a leader of writers, yeah, it's a great thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, there are lots of things. I had, in fact, I used your book's advice in a very specific way for one of the first times today.
Okay.
Where I had to meet with somebody and say, I got good news and bad news.
Right.
And having read your book, I did the bad news first. So explain why that was the right thing to do.
Okay, so
because normally you give the good news first, right? Because it feels better.
That's what I do. So what I've always done is give the good news first. Why? Because it's uncomfortable giving bad news. Why? Because I feel like if I give bad news straight away, people could shut down. Why else? You want to lay down a cushion, you know, a downy duvet of good feeling before bringing down the hammer, right? And but here's where I made the error, and it's a big error in the way we think and the way we process the world. So think about this. Think about the people in this audience, instead of saying, I've got some good news and some bad news, you're hearing that. Okay? Someone's saying to you, I've got some good news and some bad news. Which do you want to hear first? Okay, I'll just see a show of hands. How many people want to hear the good news first? Oh my gosh. How many people want to hear the bad news first? Exactly. And this is what the research says, is that we make a mistake in not really thinking through what other people want. And most people want the bad news first. And the reason for that has to go to this powerful effect that endings can have on our behavior. Endings have, of all kinds of things, have some powerful effects on our behavior. But one of the things is that we, given a choice, human beings prefer endings that elevate. We prefer rising sequences to declining sequences. And so I've changed my practice on this too. I always deliver the bad news first. Always.
For some reason, it's always stuck in my head that you should get the good news first because, like, things may change before you get to the bad news, right? You may give me the good news and then get distracted by a tweet and then, like, leave, right?
Right.
And even if in your whole life that only happens once,
right,
you're still slightly added to the good news side.
Yeah. I mean, you can argue it the other way. You could say that, you know, if you give the bad, you know, if you give the bad news first, people are so mortified they do something terrible, and you say, well, it's not actually that bad. There's some good news there as well. Yeah, there's also a whole line of jokes. You know, doctor says I've got some good news and bad news too, and so for punchlines, always do the bad news second.
All right. Well, it's Valentine's Day, so I want to talk about one of my favorite paragraphs in the book, which is the paragraph on marriage. It's like two sentences that just blew my mind. Okay. One of which you'll have to explain.
Yep.
Well, you explain the optimal time to get married. You can explain that to the audience. Okay. And then also explain why expensive wedding rings are bad.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, that's less of a timing thing, but it's an awesome one.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, happy Valentine's Day.
If you bought an expensive wedding ring or an engagement ring and you're about to bring it home to your spouse, you can leave early and trade it in.
Okay. So we'll talk about the engagement ring second, Nick. Let's talk about what we know about marriage. So this is some interesting research from Nick Wolfinger at at Utah. Take this with somewhat of a grain of salt because we're talking about large population samples, so it doesn't necessarily apply at the unit of one. But what the research shows is that there is a kind of a sweet spot for getting married, for predicting the how long the marriage is going to last, the enduringness of the marriage. And it seems to be between about age 25 and age 32. That marriages between those periods tend to last longer than marriages outside of that. So there's some remarkable numbers here. So a marriage where you get married at age 24 has an 11% greater chance of failing than getting married at age 25, believe it or not, over across a wide population sample. That said, if you get married at 35, it doesn't mean that it's doomed. God bless you for getting married. I hope it all works out. But there is that interesting kind of sweet spot. The other thing that comes up in the marriage research.
Wait, pause for a second. How do your kids feel about this? Are they going to have like their, how old are they? 19, 17, 15?
So 21, 21, 19, and 15.
So they're going to
be
scared out of their
minds. Two of whom
are
in the audience tonight. Yes.
They're going to be scared out of their minds thinking that.
Give it up for the pink children. Yeah, thank you. You know what? My hunch, we can ask them later on, but my hunch is that what they think about it is that if it's something that I've written, they haven't thought about it. Mm-hmm. That'd be my guess.
All right, so optimal time to get married, 25 to 32.
25 to 32, yeah, in general. There's also some good research on marriages are more enduring if people get married after they finish their education, no matter what level of education they have, again, across broad samples. I think the more interesting one is this. This is research out of Emory. There's some very intriguing research showing an inverse relationship between how much a couple's family spends on the wedding and spends on the engagement ring and how likely that marriage is to last. That is, the more you spend, the less likely the marriage is to last.
Mm-hmm. And that is because?
Well, okay, so interesting. So why would you think?
Guess because you're overcompensating, right? You're trying to like make up for the fact that you're not certain you're in love, and so you're sticking all the money into it just to try to like make everybody feel better about it.
That would be the logical explanation for it. We don't know because we're only talking about correlation here. But the explanation that these researchers give. See, I thought originally it's like that. It's like, oh, you have materialistic values rather than non-materialistic values, and materialistic values are ephemeral, and therefore the marriage is going to crumble. What they said was they think it's something else. One of the big causes of divorce is financial stress and financial conflict. And what they said is that when couples spend a lot of money on a marriage or a wedding or an engagement ring, they actually, if they're not well off, they can actually start a marriage in more debt than they should, and that debt hangs on them and causes financial conflict that ultimately leads to divorce. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone.
Yeah. On that note. Since we're talking about fathers and children, when I turned 40, my dad posted on my Facebook page publicly for 75,000 people or whatever it is. He posted, "Hey, Nick, congratulations on turning 40. Your life is growing great. You have a wonderful wife, a wonderful job, wonderful kids, but you've now reached the age when all men's lives fall apart." I hope you can power through this. Lord knows I didn't. Like, that is the entirety. Wow. Public. And right, this is like a public page. Like, I'm working at the New Yorker. Like, this is like going out to the world. You think my dad was wrong, right? Lives don't fall apart at 40.
No, I don't think they do.
And explain the midlife crisis.
I think some lives fall apart at 40.
Explain midlife crisis, because when I read that chapter of your book, all I could think about was my dad and that note.
Okay, so midlife crises. All right, so I have a chapter on midpoints, and midpoints have a very peculiar effect on us. It's sort of a dual and sometimes opposite effect. Now, you've all heard of the midlife crisis, all right? And the midlife crisis is complete bunk. All right, there is no evidence of a midlife crisis as a phenomenon. It's complete garbage. It really is. But there's something else more interesting that I think goes on at midlife, and this actually has some science behind it, and it's this. There is, in general, a U-shaped curve for well-being over time. And what's so interesting about that midlife U is that this pattern has been found in something like 70 countries. If I were to show you the chart, show you three charts and say to you, one of these is the United States, one of these is Greece, and one of these is the United Arab Emirates, you would not be able to tell the difference. It's not a national difference, a cultural difference. It's something really interesting about this.
But that chart, which shows, shows sort of satisfaction with where you are, does show like a bottoming in the middle of your life.
Yeah, it's not a crisis. It basically shows that it's not static. It doesn't go up, but mm-hmm. it shows a sag rather than any kind of
midlife sag.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, tell me, but here's the best news of all. I don't know, why are we having a parade of bad news? But let me march behind you in this parade of bad news. The absolute bottom point for well-being for American men is 50.
This moment.
No. 50, yeah. Well, you're close.
I mean, clearly for men in this country, like, men are doing really badly. 52. It's their own fault.
52.9 years is the absolute bottom for male well-being in America.
How 52.9. Old are you?
I'm 53. So, yeah. So, yeah.
So, okay, let's go back to the age thing.
But can I add one more thing on midpoints?
Yeah.
Because it's very, very interesting. There are a couple of different things. So when we think about the main thing to think about in terms of time here is that some of our time is demarcated in units, like minutes and seconds and hours and things like that. But much of our lives are episodic, all right? It's a series of episodes. And episodes have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And any sort of episode, any sort of encounter that you know has a beginning and probably has an end, by its nature has a midpoint. And we're kind of oblivious to midpoints. And midpoints have this very peculiar effect. So you have so think about that curve for well-being, but that's not it. Believe it or not, I'm going to give you two more examples here. Believe it or not, there is research on the well-being of great apes. Now, how can you do well-being on great apes? How can you measure well-being of great apes? Well, great apes have human caretakers. Great apes in captivity have human caretakers. And so the human caretakers can assess, is this ape socializing? Is this ape eating with gusto? Is this ape, you know, in a decent mood? And what they found, when you look at well-being for apes, kind of peculiar.
Through their lives.
Now, the good news is that most the very few apes live to 53, so mm-hmm. I got that going for me. Mm-hmm. But there's also something very intriguing here. So even though it's Valentine's Day, let me give you an example, the example of Hanukkah.
Yep.
Okay? Let's talk Hanukkah here. Hanukkah is a holiday that has 8 nights, all right? And on each night, Jews who celebrate the holiday light a candle. 1 candle on night 1, 2 candles on night 2, 3 candles on night 3, and so forth, right? So that's how Jews observe the holiday. Or do they? Ayelet Fishbach at University of Chicago mm-hmm. actually looked at this. She has a paper on Hanukkah candle lighting behavior. I kid you not. And you know what it looks like? People are pumped about lighting candles on night 1. Then they grow less interested. By night 4, no one's into it. And then, oh my God, it's night 8, boom, and we're back in action. And so you see other kinds of patterns like this. You ask people to do certain kinds of tasks, they become less compliant in the middle. So there's something really intriguing going on in midpoints.
How did you find this paper on candle lighting? Like, is it a paper about 100 interesting things about candle lighting, you just happen to read it and notice that about midpoints? Or is it a paper about timing, but like, honestly, like, what is this paper on? Is that the only conclusion of the paper?
No, they do some other, interesting things. Well, you know what? I kind of stumbled into it. I'll tell you the story because
it seems interesting.
Yeah, there's you
and probably happened early or late in your research.
I got to it because I was looking. I was actually looking for research on holidays because there's some interesting research on how people change their behavior at certain kinds of temporal landmarks, and I think I stumbled onto it that way. But they've also done experimental things where you ask people to put them in a room and say, cut out these 5 shapes in mm-hmm. a certain way, or 7 shapes. They cut out these 7 shapes in a certain way. I'm going to leave the room and then look at them, and they number the shapes, and people are very diligent at the first ones and very diligent at the last ones, but they sag in their compliance in the middle. So there's something very peculiar about this sag at midpoints. Midpoints also have the exact opposite effect. Midpoints can actually be sparks as well. So if you think about teams, Connie Gersick at UCLA, now at Yale, has done some research on teams. And so we tend to think about the way that teams work. Okay, here's a team assembles, and then that's the deadline. And the way that teams operate is that they basically make steady progress like this. And what Gersick found is that it doesn't work that way. That at the beginning of a project, Nick, you run a lot of projects. What do you think people do at the beginning of a project?
They're pumped.
They get pumped, right. In other words, they don't do anything, all right? They have feelings. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of feels. There's a lot of posturing, but very little gets done. And it's only, she said, Connie Gersick says, that at a certain moment in this concentrated burst of activity, teams really get going. They abandon the posturing and the feelings, and they get going. And she found that that moment was at the exact temporal midpoint of a project.
You're listening to behavior expert Daniel Pink, whose new book is When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. He's joined in conversation by Wired Magazine's Nicholas Thompson on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Does it matter whether you know the endpoint, right? So let's take book writing.
Yeah.
If you start a book and you don't have a deadline, do you sag halfway through what eventually becomes the amount of time? Or is it only in the case where you have a deadline of 2 years where you've sort of sag in sort of, you know, months?
Well, I think for something like that, where you have that kind of deadline, you can have a sag in certain... What's interesting is that you can go both ways at the midpoint. So in Gersick's research, the midpoint basically what... I think it's true for books. And I think as a writer, you're a writer too, you might understand this. What happens is that if you have a team that's doing a project and they're not doing very much at the beginning, they get to the midpoint. And Gersick's research, what she did to understand the ground truth of how teams actually operate, she videotaped and audiotaped all of these sessions of these teams meeting. And it was really at that midpoint where someone said, hey, guys, we've squandered half of our time. We got to get going. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, I like to call that the uh-oh effect, where people go, uh-oh, we've wasted half of our time. We got to get going. And I think that in that case, with a book project, it's like, oh, my God, I had 2 years. I've already squandered a year. I better get going.
Right. But it's you're more likely to have that moment if you have an end point, right, as opposed to just an open-ended contract, right?
Yeah. We have other writers in the audience, and you can probably speak to this as well. I think that a writer with an open-ended deadline is someone who's not going to write anything.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm mostly an editor, so yes, yeah. I'm on your team here. All right. Let's talk about SAGs, and let's talk about the course of a day.
Yeah.
Explain, when should people do important things? First thing in the morning, late at night, middle of the day?
Depends on what those things are. Here's what the research shows. And some really, really cool research from big data analysis of tweets to some of Daniel Kahneman's work is basically this, that the day typically unfolds for us in three stages, a peak, a trough, and a rebound. In general, our mood goes up, then it drops considerably, then it goes back up again. Peak, trough, recovery. And over and over again, in different kinds of ways that scientists have measured that pattern, they come to that same conclusion, peak, trough, recovery. That ends up giving us some very interesting clues about when we should do certain kinds of work. And now most of us move through the day peak, trough, recovery. For people who are strong night owls, about 20% of us, it's the other direction, recovery, trough, peak. But what the research says pretty clearly is this. During the peak, which for most of us is the morning, we should be doing analytic work. Work that requires heads down, focus, diligence. The key word here actually is vigilance, comes out in all the research, all right? We're vigilant then. We're able to bat away distractions. So that peak is when you should be doing writing something, writing a report, or analyzing data, or figuring out a strategy. During the trough, that middle period, which that's not good for very much at all. I mean, there's a lot of bad stuff that goes on in the trough, which we might...
And that's from like 9 a.m. to 4 p.m.?
Yeah, 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 yeah. A lot of bad stuff that goes on, a lot of bad stuff that goes on in the trough. And so that's better. You're better off doing your administrative work then, you know, answering your emails or filling out your TPS reports or whatever you're doing there. And then what's interesting about the later part of the day for most of us is that you have elevated mood and less vigilance. And that's a potent combination, because your mood is better, you're a little bit looser. That makes it a good time for creativity, insight problems, brainstorming, and whatnot. And so what the research shows pretty darn clearly is that we should do our analytic work during the peak, our administrative work during the trough, and our more creative insight work during the recovery. And what's sort of frustrating about all of this is that if you look at the data, time of day effects explain about 20% of the variance in how people perform on workplace tasks. Right, that's a big deal. But the other thing is that in organizations, we're completely blind to this, and we're completely unintentional about how we schedule things. So think about meetings. There's only one criterion for scheduling a meeting in every organization essentially on this planet: availability. That's it. We don't think about what kind of meeting it is, what kind of meeting is this? Is this a meeting that requires analysis? Is it a meeting that requires brainstorming? Is this a purely administrative meeting? We don't think about that. So what happens in organizations is you've got these groups of people who are, you know, morning people, larks, who should be left alone to do their analytic work, and their boss schedules a meeting about the travel voucher policy at 9:30 in the morning. And because scheduling isn't considered a strategic issue. And I think if we move things around a little bit, or our bosses move things around, there's going to be actually a nice way to turn up the dial on both productivity and creativity.
I'm about to cancel the travel voucher meeting tomorrow morning at Wired.
Yeah.
I was actually, while you were saying all that, I was thinking about the President of the United States, because I think he follows the pattern, right? He tweets early in the morning, tweets late at night. He's like tweeting in the peaks and like doing national security work in the troughs.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
So how much of this peak and trough in the course of the day, how much of it is inevitable and how much of it can be changed, right? I mean, if you eat an efficient breakfast, if you, you know, schedule yourself properly, if you take a nap at the right time, like, does this have to be the case, or is it a function of some other societal things that we've layered on?
No, I think that it's actually mostly biological. I mean, I think that
why do our bodies work this way?
Well, I mean, who knows? But there's an evolutionary argument for the trough. There's a definite evolutionary argument for the midday trough. Because remember, our brains evolved not in a world of time zones and Twitter and instant communication. Our brains evolved on a savanna where we weren't communicating, where we didn't have buildings to be in. And so what probably happened is that the people who had a genetic propensity to kind of space out and get tired around midday when the sun was at the highest, they lived. And the people who didn't have that capacity stayed out in the sun and died. And their genes didn't go to the next generation. And I think there's an evolutionary explanation about it. The problem, you know, the thing is that we are biological creatures and we are temporal creatures. And there's not, you know, we need to reckon with that and re-architect our days to take advantage of that.
Yeah. The data in the book that I think the single chart that blew my mind the most was parole decisions and time of day.
Oh, yeah.
I unfathomable. Explain this to everybody.
Oh, yeah. This is alarming. Okay, so this is a study out of Israel of parole boards. And so what you had is you had prisoners coming before judges, and the judges were making decisions about whether to grant parole. You don't have to stay in prison anymore. You can go free. Or questions or judgments about whether that prisoner has an ankle monitor or has to have the ankle monitor removed. So these are pretty weighty decisions about human liberty. And what the research shows is that early in the day, first session, you have a very good chance of getting parole. Then it drops, and 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 it really, really drops. Say the judge has a break, takes a break to do whatever judges do on breaks, right? The judge comes back from the break, your chance goes back up to here. And then it drops, and it drops, and it drops, and it drops, and it's dropped. Then let's say the judge has another break. Right after the break, goes back up there. And so if you are a potential parolee, and through completely the randomness and luck of how much certain cases took before you, if you come in right before that break, you're staying in prison. If you come in after the break, you have something like a 70% chance of going free.
Because the thing that blew my mind is I saw this chart and I was like, oh yeah, so the y-axis must be between like 52 and 57%. And it's not. It's between 0 and 100.
Exactly. I do not. I generally resist the broken y-axis in my charts. Yeah.
I'm very grateful for that.
And so, we're talking literally in that chart, we're talking literally a percentage before a break in the single digits, and after a break, upwards around 70.
And how convinced are you that this is due to our biological rhythms and not some other quirk of the justice system or some other quirk of the study? I mean, these numbers, insane, 70% to 0% on whether the judge is cranky or, like, tired?
Yes, because we are biological creatures, and we don't have inexhaustible stores of energy. And you see this in other kinds of judicial decision making. You see this in research on juries. I'll give you an example in juries that's also alarming. So some experimental research with juries. Let's say you give, we draw a line down the center of this audience, all right, and we give you some facts of a case, and you have to make a decision about a criminal defendant's guilt. You get your defendant, same set of facts, your defendant is named Robert Garner. Your defendant is named Roberta Garcia. If you deliberate in the morning, those you two make the same, both groups make the same decisions. If you deliberate in the afternoon, your groups are more likely to exonerate Garner and convict Garcia. Wow. Right? Yeah, that's a wow, thank you. That's a wow. And so you have these things. And so a lot of this research says, I mean, what it says so clearly is that we do not perform the same way at the time of day has an effect on our performance. We don't perform the same at this time versus that time. And it has material consequences. Want to talk about healthcare?
Let's talk about healthcare, because that's shocking too.
The healthcare is shocking. I mean, yeah. Basically, truly, if you take nothing else away from this, you should do, one of them is always give the bad news first. The second one is this. Don't go to the hospital or schedule an important doctor's appointment in the afternoon. No, I mean it. I'm dead serious about this. All right? Let me give you the parade of startling, horrific factoids. Anesthesia errors. 4 times more likely at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m. Yeah, that's a wow. All right? Let's talk about hand washing in hospitals. Nurses hand washing in hospitals, okay? Pew! All right? Much less likely to wash hands in the afternoon, leading to hospital-acquired infections. Let's, you know, as Nick hinted at earlier, it's Valentine's Day. Let's talk about colonoscopies. All right? Colonoscopies. Endoscopists find half as many polyps in afternoon exams as they do in morning exams. Right? Doctor is much more likely to prescribe unnecessary antibiotics in afternoon exams versus morning exams. I mean, it's unbelievable.
So if you do have an afternoon doctor's appointment, make sure it's with somebody who's just pulled an all-nighter, right? I mean, because like, yeah. Doctors should have the most messed up circadian rhythms. You would actually think that the crazy sleep schedules would break these patterns.
Well, yeah, I mean, certain kinds of doctors, too. And those crazy sleep patterns, we know from all kinds of research, can have a devastating effect. Now, the good news here, just to be fair, is that there are remedies for this. So I write in there about going to the University of Michigan Medical Center and standing in on a
yeah,
surgery.
That was great.
And there are things that doctors, that surgical teams can do to mitigate some of this. So things like timeouts, where before you begin the procedure, people literally take a step back from the table and go over what are we doing, who's doing what, to maintain the vigilance that might ebb during that period. The solution for nurses, which is a powerful solution in many, many domains, was to give nurses more breaks and give them certain kinds of breaks. You give nurses more breaks, and particularly social breaks, and the hand washing goes back up. But you also see this in education too, in a very alarming way. So if you look at there's a great piece of research from Francesca Gino at Harvard about test scores in Denmark. So students in Denmark take tests, the standardized tests, on computers, not on pencil and paper. And a typical Danish school has more students than computers, so everybody can't take the test at the same time. So they're randomly assigned to take the test at different times of day. Morning test takers, afternoon test takers. Afternoon test takers score as if they had missed 2 weeks of school. Wow, exactly. Now, the remedy for that was to give, if you give kids a 20 to 30 minute break before they take the test in the afternoon, their scores go back up. So what we're learning about breaks is that they are a powerful part of our well-being and our performance.
Recess for everybody, particularly judges and doctors and
yeah,
caretakers.
But think about that. I mean, there is, you know, there's something to be said for like some form of kind of adult recess. I mean, that's what those judges were doing. Those judges were taking a break. I don't know whether they're out on like the judicial jungle gym or anything like that, having little sippy cups of judge apple juice, but there's something going on in that. There's something going on, we know from breaks, that are restorative, that changes how we feel, how we behave, and how we decide.
So let's talk. I buy almost everything in this book. And whenever I'm up for my parole decision, okay, it's going to be in the morning. I don't buy what you say about naps.
Okay, you're wrong.
I think what
Nick.
You say about naps
wrong,
is
yeah.
garbage.
Yeah.
So this guy
I'll
says,
tell you stuff. There's much,
hold on.
That's solid, Nick. There's other stuff in there that's more garbagey than that. So, yeah. Yeah.
This man literally claims that what you need to do in the middle of the day is drink a cup of coffee and fall asleep and then wake up. So explain, convince the audience whether this is right or not.
Okay, here we go. I'm not sure what they're
clearly
applauding
on
for.
Your side, but...
No, I don't...
I haven't tested this.
I think they were applauding for the pointed question. So, stick with me on this, all right? Naps, all right? Naps are actually powerful. Now, are we having any hockey fans in the audience by any chance?
Yes.
Wow, okay. That's how a hockey fan would answer that question,
right? Yeah,
that's
good. That was
they
legit.
Bang their next-door neighbor against the boards. Naps are like Zambonis for our brain. All right, our brain has all kinds of nicks and scuffs over the course of a day, and naps come in, smooth things out. But what the research on naps shows is that the most efficient nap is extraordinarily short. It's really between 10 and 20 minutes long. You go longer than that, you begin to develop what's called sleep inertia, which is that kind of groggy, boggy feeling you get if you nap too long. So a 10 to 20 minute nap is really the ideal. But there's a way to turbocharge it. And Nick is skeptical of this. And appropriately is skeptical of this. And the evidence here is pretty clear. And I actually want to encourage you to try this. The ideal nap goes like this. Truly, the ideal nap goes like this. You should try to find your daily low point, which is typically about 7 hours after you wake up. Right? And so what I do, and my wife is also here. Give it up for my wife. Okay, thank you. And she can attest to this, is that I will do this, is, okay, so 7 hours after I wake up, that's my low point, and then what I will do is I will sit in a chair in my office, and I have headphones, all right, put on my headphones, okay, and I will set my phone for 25-minute countdown timer. Then, to Nick's disbelief, I will have a cup of coffee. Stick with me, folks, all right? Now, I can, and napping is somewhat like meditation, that you can get better at it the more you try. I can typically fall asleep in maybe 10 minutes, right? When I'm at that low point and I have quiet.
And a cup of coffee in you.
Hang on, young man, all right? So here we go. I have a cup of coffee, all right? Let's just get... So I put on my headphones, go to sleep in a chair, can usually fall asleep in 10 minutes. My alarm goes off, and I've had that 15-minute nap right in that sweet spot. But here's where it gets interesting. It takes 25 minutes for caffeine to get into your bloodstream. So, at the moment that I'm waking up, the caffeine hits my bloodstream. I have the wakefulness, lack of sleep inertia, and this added boost of caffeine. This is something known as a nappuccino. So, you know what I think we should do? I think that Wired should live stream Nick doing a nappuccino. I do.
It's the coffee, right? I buy the like the Napa Zamboni for your mind, but yeah. I feel like putting coffee in is like putting a drunk driver in the Zamboni.
No, you know what it is? It's basically refueling the Zamboni's tank so it can Zamboni again. Right. I'm going to lose the Zamboni metaphor here.
All right. We are going to test that live on Wired.com tomorrow. Nick Thompson falls asleep at his desk with headphones on.
I think it would be good.
Tell me the other things that you've changed in your life. I want to hear what else have you done that you did not do 2 years ago because of your research. And also, while you're at it, throw in one thing that you kind of bought and started doing and then decided it was BS.
Okay. No, that's a great question. Let me see. Something I started doing... Okay, I'll give you an example of that. So let's talk about best time of day to exercise. Right, the research on this is actually pretty clear, and it depends on your goals. So you should exercise in the morning if you want to have, it seems to be better for habit formation, it seems to be better for weight loss, and exercise gives us a mood boost. So if you exercise in the morning, you get that mood boost throughout the day, you don't sleep it off. All right, and so on habit formation, okay, I want to always have the habit of exercise.
Yep.
And I realize that when I exercise in the morning, I hate it. I hate it. I feel awful. I feel like I feel like the Tin Man in the Wizard of Oz, like creak, 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 creak. And I don't like it. And it was not habit forming for me. The other side of it, though, is that exercising later in the day has other virtues. One, it's better for avoiding injury because we have changes in our body temperature, yeah. And so we're literally more warmed up. Second, and here's where I think it gets somewhat interesting, people who exercise in the afternoon and early evening report enjoying it more. They report finding it less effortful, probably because of body temperature. There are also some very interesting stuff, interesting research showing that a disproportionate number of records in speed events take place between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. And so it can be performance enhancing for speed. So I tried the morning exercise. It didn't form a habit for me. I tried the afternoon, and it worked great for me, I think because I simply enjoy it more.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features behavior expert Daniel Pink, whose new book is When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. He's joined in conversation by Wired Magazine's Nicholas Thompson. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So give us some other tips. So you exercise in the afternoon, you do your nappuccinos, you get up at the right time of day. What else?
I try to just wake up when I wake up if I don't have anything to do. You know what? I actually have become... I think in a big picture, I become much more conscious of time and much more conscious of the temporal aspects of our lives. So if you look at something like endings, all right, I've become much more conscious of how things end. We know there's a lot of research on endings, and the research on endings show they have a huge effect on how people behave. So for instance, Nick is a pretty accomplished long distance runner. And so you've run multiple marathons, right? So Nick has run multiple marathons. So think about the most common age at which people run their first marathon is age 29. Think about that for a second. 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a first marathon as 28-year-olds. 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a first marathon as 30-year-olds. Okay, now guess what other age people are disproportionately likely to run their first marathon? 39. You guys are geniuses, all right? Take a wild guess. This is a harder one. Guess what other age people are disproportionately likely to run their first marathon? 49. Very good. 49-year-olds. 49. They're niners. They're nine-enders. Yeah. That's what the researchers call them. 49-year-olds are three times more likely to run a first marathon as 50-year-olds. And so... there's something about endings that energize us. Even the sort of the arbitrary ending of a decade gets us to energize, gets us to kick a little bit harder. And so I become more conscious of how endings can energize us. If I have an offer or something like that in my newsletter, I will definitely put a deadline on it, because the ending becomes salient. There's when you think about how people remember encounters, the way that people encode experiences, the way they evaluate and remember these experiences is keyed very much to how the experience ends. It's true for everything from family vacations, it's true for entire lives. People will rate the morality of somebody's life differently based on the final year of their life and how they behaved, and essentially underweight the rest of their life. You look at something as mundane as Yelp reviews. So any of you who are in consumer-facing businesses, this is a big deal. You look at Yelp reviews. Just randomly pull up some Yelp restaurant reviews, and what you'll see is a disproportionate number of people are rating the restaurant based on what happened at the end of the meal. They screwed up my check, and they were jerks about it. I hate this place. They gave me a free dessert. I love this place. I left my keys in the booth, and they ran after me into the parking lot, which actually happens surprisingly often. You see this encountered a lot. I love this place. So if you're more intentional and conscious about endings, that's something that I've done. And also, just in terms of my own daily work schedule, I was edging toward this myself, but I'm pretty rigid now how I schedule my work. So I do all, when I'm writing, I do all of my writing in the morning. I probably wrote 90% of the words in that book before noon. And then in the afternoon, I try to do the nonsense stuff. And then in the late afternoon and early evening, that's when I like to do my interviews, because I like my interviews to be a little bit more, freewheeling, a little bit more iterative. And so I've changed the way that I do my own schedule.
So my last question is, while you're doing this research, you're reading your 200 scientific papers, tell me the moment where something kind of shook your thesis, where something made you question something or surprise you or was sort of startling that you really had to reckon with.
Yeah. Some of it was talk about like something like how do seasons affect us, all right? Mm-hmm. What's the effect of seasons on our behavior? And I looked at that and said, you know what? We don't know the answer to that question,
yeah.
Right? How about a lot of people are interested in, okay, what time should you eat? Certain kinds of, you know, what time of the day should you eat? And I looked at that research and I said, you know what? It's contradictory. It is mm-hmm. it is tangled, and I don't think we know the answer to that question. So even though I had that question, I wanted to know the answer to that question, the research didn't tell me we know the answer to that question yet.
So there were a bunch of big things where you couldn't quite figure it out.
No, because I'm just looking at the research and seeing what essentially what other people have figured out. And if it's clear that they don't know, then I don't want to go tell readers something that isn't right.
Well, thank you for that, except for your nap stuff. Okay, so. Who has questions? All right.
Hi. So my sister, pastry chef at a big hotel. Cookies at 3 o'clock is a huge, huge thing. So if ever I'm going to a full day meeting, she's like, are you going to have cookies at 3 o'clock? Are they going to give you cookies at 3 o'clock? So is that the way that we artificially manage troughs and have always done that instinctively?
Perhaps. Perhaps. I mean, I think the best remedy for troughs are breaks. And caffeine, especially nappuccinos. But I think actually the 3 o'clock break for cookies is actually something very, very. I think there's something even more interesting going on with that, which is that I write a little bit about how do groups coordinate in time, how do groups synchronize, choral groups, rowing groups, teams operating in harmony over time, and one of the things that that helps groups synchronize in time is a sense of belonging. That they belong together. And one of the things that fosters belongings are certain kinds of rituals, usually self-organized rituals. And so that sounds to me as much like a bonding agent for a group of people as it does as a remedy for a trough.
Considering your spouse and your kids, I'm sure, have read your book, are there times when you have arguments or disagreements and you say, you know, the timing for this is not right, so we should table this and talk about this later?
Yeah, the handful of people who know my family members would know instantly that would not work. No, I haven't tried that one, and since some of them are here, I can't use it now. So, but you make an interesting point about how do we persuade other people and the timing effects of how we persuade other people. And I think that one of the lessons from the judge research that Nick mentioned is this. When human beings make decisions, you got to think about how human beings make decisions. When we make decisions, we often come in with a default decision in our back pocket. Right? And the default decision, so let's say you go to your boss and ask for a raise. Your boss's default decision, she's going to say no. That's her default decision, right? You go, you're selling something, and your prospect, the default decision is no. You ask somebody out on a date, the default decision, well, I mean, it depends on who you are, but the default decision is
definitely no.
At least it was in my experience, probably Nick's experience too. The default, he was nodding. The default is no. So when are people, this is how you think about it, when are people likely to overcome the default? And what the judges were doing in that study, forget about the fact that they were making decisions about human liberty just for a moment. What they were doing is they were just making decisions. And the default decision when somebody comes in and asks for parole is no. And they were willing to overcome the default early in the day and immediately after breaks. And I think that actually gives us clues about the temporal aspects of persuasion. Now, this doesn't lock it down, whether your ability to persuade somebody. None of this stuff does. What we're talking about here is probabilities. So let's say that you're selling something and you have a 15% chance of selling something. But if you do it at the right time, maybe that dials it up to a 20% chance of selling something. All right, you still have an 80% chance of failing. But you know what? Over time, I will totally take a jump from 15% probability to 20% probability over time, because over time, that pays off. So there are some temporal aspects of decision making. There's some other interesting things in temporal aspects of people, like in job interviews and people being in what are called serial competitions, SERIAL competitions. Like, there's certain advantages in going first. There's certain advantages in going last, based on a whole array of factors. So when we talk about sort of timing for persuading people, it actually does play a role.
Okay.
Hi, Dan. Given that the audience is mostly larks and third birds, what's the ideal? Can you just do a walkthrough of the ideal schedule from morning until night? You've talked about pieces of it.
Yeah. So basically, okay, so again, there are ideal design principles. But one of the most important things that I think comes out of this, and even that comes out of my writing it and thinking about it, is how much we have to get better at observing our own behavior. We're largely clueless about our own behavior, how we're doing, how we're feeling, how we're performing. It's sort of invisible, and so we need to be more observant of our own behavior. But I think the design principles are pretty clear. So if you're a lark or a third bird, you want to do your analytic work during the morning. You can't say, everybody should start at 7:41 and end at 11:02. No, you got to figure that out on your own. But do that locked-down work where it requires vigilance and focus, do that in the morning. 80% of us should be doing that in the morning. The owl should be doing that much later in the day. And what it means is that you have to be intentional about preserving that time. So for me, it's like, this is why when I write, I turn off my email. I close my email. I turn off my phone. My wife actually stopped me, especially after January 20th, 2017, from looking at Twitter. I've had days before being as intentional about this, where it's like, okay, writing moment, let's go down, let's get to write, it's the morning. Oh, let me just check a few emails. And a few emails becomes 32 emails. And I've sent 32 emails and responded to 32 emails, and then I do that, and then, you know, three ESPN highlight reels later, it's time for lunch. And I've completely squandered my time. And so I think it's that preserve that peak period in the morning. Really, we have a lot of administrative work, a lot of work that doesn't require heavy cognitive loads. Move that to the early to mid-afternoon.
That's the highlight reels.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. You know what? Believe it or not, there is actually research on how watching dog videos can be restorative. So turn on the ESPN Westminster channel. It's awesome. Yeah. And then later in the day, you want to do work that requires a little bit more looseness. So anything that's creative. And I think what you have to do is you just have to be intentional about when you schedule stuff, when you do stuff, but also observant of your own behavior. So are you better off starting your day at, you know, there's some people out there, oh, everybody should start your day really, really early. You start at 5:30. That doesn't work for a lot of people. So find your ideal starting time. Is it 7:30? Is it 8? Is it 8:30? Preserve that time for analytic work. Move your administrative stuff to the trough and do other kinds of stuff late in the day. I write about, I had somebody who was helping me in the research do an analysis. There's a terrific book out there called Daily Rituals that I really want, edited by a guy named Mason Curry. And what it is, it's a collection of accounts of how famous artists, novelists, inventors, scientists, how they actually scheduled their day. It's a lovely book. It's a terrific book. But what I asked one of the people helping me in research do is like go into there and actually find out what are the patterns these people are doing. And what it was is about 60% of the people, these great artists, these great composers, these great scientists, had that kind of a pattern. They worked heads down in the morning. They did sort of the crappy stuff in the afternoon. They came back to things in a slightly different way later in the afternoon, and they took off the evening. And so I'm not saying that's the platonic ideal of everybody's schedule, but I do think that these design principles point us in a direction kind of sort of like that.
My question has to do with birth time and whether the mythology around birth order and birth time has any bearing in the reality of the research, whether you're born at a certain time of day or a certain month with the whole horoscope thing. Did any of that turn up in your research?
Yeah, there's the only thing that happened in terms of birth season, there actually is something interesting like that. People who are born in the fall and the winter are more likely to be owls, and people born in the summer and spring are more likely to be larks. Kind of interesting. And the reasoning behind it is basically exposure to sunlight in the womb. In terms of horoscopes, it's BS. In terms of in terms of birth order. I don't write about this, but there's some really, really interesting stuff on birth order. It's a very controversial issue. There's a book by a guy named Frank Soloway called Born to Rebel. He's a Harvard professor, and his theory of birth order is basically this, that essentially firstborns are generals, and laterborns are revolutionaries. And the reason for that is this kind of struggle for parental attention and approval. And so firstborns try to consolidate power because they have all the resources to themselves. Laterborns, because there's already somebody in the picture, they have to come up with more inventive, innovative strategies to try to gain that parent. So it's very hard to, you know, I mean, it's sort of like that old joke. It's like there are two kinds of people in the world. Those who believe that that everything comes in twos and the rest of us. So that's it. There is some interesting evidence, though, about firstborns performing better academically. That seems pretty clear. And that could be a question of parental resources. That's very clear. Firstborns perform better academically than laterborns. The second thing is there's some really interesting stuff in baseball, believe it or not, that laterborns are players who are laterborns, not firstborns, are actually steal bases more frequently. which actually sort of validates the idea of like alternative strategies, revolutionary strategies, something like that. But again, you know, your mileage may vary.
How would you compare Nappuccinos to a walk, a brisk walk?
I think they're great, and I think that they're. It depends on. It's a matter of personal preference. What we do know, you're dead right about breaks. What we know about breaks is that we should be taking more breaks, and we should be taking certain kinds of breaks. And the kinds of breaks we should be taking, and the research is super clear on this, is the following: that something is better than nothing. So taking any kind of break is better than not taking a break. We have to get over this sort of hyper-puritanical view that we should be powering through, that powering through is good for our productivity and that it's morally virtuous. That's nonsense. So something is better than nothing. We know also, to your question, that moving is better than being stationary and during a break. We also know that social is better than solo, even for introverts. So breaks with somebody else whom you've chosen, you know, not have foisted on you, but breaks with somebody else who, actually autonomy is a big factor in replenishing breaks. So break with somebody else is more replenishing than breaks solo, even for introverts. And so the hand-washing example, the nurses had social breaks that got them going better. And we also know, to your point, that that outside is better than inside. The replenishing effects of nature are pretty staggering. And then we also know that full detachment is better than semi-detachment. And so if there is sort of a platonic ideal of a break, because obviously napping isn't for everybody in every situation, if there's a platonic ideal of a break, it is going outside for a walk with someone you like without your phone talking about something other than work. So there's a very, very strong argument for taking walks.
Or taking a nap outside with a younger sibling.
Right.
Of a friend. Right.
But your younger sibling will sabotage you because they're vying for parental power.
All right. The bad news. We're done. The good news. Books are available and this man will sign them. Thank you very much for coming.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was behavior expert Daniel Pink, whose new book is When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. He was joined in conversation by Wired Magazine's Nicholas Thompson. The recording engineers of the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.